Yeah, good morning, everyone. I hope you had a good rest for the second part. So the question where we ended up yesterday was essentially, can we come up with an experiment whose outcome is inconsistent with the joint assumption of the validity of GR and quantum theory? Just for a second, I have the... Yeah, exactly. I have on the monitor screen, I have my online translation of my talk. Can we somehow change that? Sorry. Thank you. It's funny to read what you say, actually. Because not, you know, normally they say, don't listen to what I say, listen to what I mean. But if you, while you say it, read it, it sort of gets a different meaning. Oh, thank you. That is helpful. Okay. And basically, I showed you historical analogies from quantum optics, where one of the big successes in the history of quantum optics was essentially the incompatibility theorems that allowed to distinguish different, eventually then through Bell's theorem, actually worldviews, if you want. And I guess the one of the big questions behind what I was trying to motivate yesterday is, can we also come up with similar incompatibility theorems when we talk about the quantum nature of gravity? Which, of course, well, means we would have to define what that means and so on. So and I'm trying to provide a path in this direction. Okay, so we ended up here. I think we all agree that if we would have now a source mass in a superposition, we couple the source mass to a second test mass, then just by gravitational interaction, the system will become entangled. And if you apply a field view of gravity, so just standard GR, and try to explain this experiment, you would not expect entanglement to happen because the test mass would just follow basically a geodesic in a metric that is fixed, and so we don't see entanglement. So the question that I now want to address for the almost remainder of the talk is, well, how reasonable from an experimental point of view is it to think about such an experiment? Okay, so let's just put a few numbers and then see where we are experimentally with respect to the numbers that we would expect to do something like that. Okay, so... first approach, so let's start with two particles. We have here particle mass 1 and mass 2, and just for simplicity, I just stick to one mass, so meaning the mass is always same size. And this is now, this is the x direction here, okay, x1, x2. The two particles are kept at a distance d, right? And these two are quantum systems. So that means we can describe those two masses with a wave packet along x, right? Like that. And the extent of the wave packet is our sigma of the particle. Okay, that's the size of the delocalization, if you want.
Isn't there in the d direction as well?
I don't care about the d direction.
Ah.
I'm just looking at the x direction.
Okay.
Because then, in that case, I don't have to worry if I have a large sigma that would then start to overlap, would be larger than d, then things become messy. I don't want that, so I just go in this geometry.
Is bigger. So you don't care if there is overlap of like.
No, in that case, I assume that the uncertainty in the d direction is smaller,
ah,
so
okay.
I can neglect
that's
that.
Okay.
Yeah, right.
So
essentially, we make that more or less a 1D problem for the time being. Okay. Well, so what's next? You ask. Well, what is the interaction here, right? Well, then the interaction is obviously, well, just proportional to g m squared divided by r, right? Where r is now, r in that case between the two masses is simply the square root, so it's g m square divided by the square root of d square plus x1 minus x2 square. Right? So this is now the distance between the two masses. Well, so then if you Taylor expand this thing, then this is approximately, right, this is approximately then g m square divided by d, right? And then you get a 1, then you get a minus x1 minus x2 squared divided by d square, and so on, and higher order terms that we then neglect, okay? So if you continue in this direction, that means it's g m square over d, and then you have here a 1 minus, and you see now basically you have three terms. You get an x1 square over, there's a 2 somewhere, x1 square over 2d square minus x2 square over 2d square. Then there's a plus x1 x2 divided by d square. And then the higher order terms of the Taylor. Okay? Those terms don't contribute to the interaction between the particles. So this is, you see, this is just if you think of it in terms of forces, these are just position-dependent forces that act on each of the particles individually. So that just modifies the spring constant of these two systems. So those we don't care, but what we care is the interaction term. And what you see is what we get now is an interaction term that looks like that. That's g m square over d. Times over d cubed times x1, x2. And this interaction term here, this is an entangling term. So x, this is an xx coupling between two harmonic oscillators. This is essentially what we have here. Right? And none of that is surprising. Okay, I have two harmonic oscillators, they're coupled via 1 over r potential, then they become entangled, and the origin of the entanglement is that the 1 over r potential to the first non-trivial order is just an xx coupling between the two, and this is an entangling. This is an entangling in Hamiltonian. Okay, so and then of course what I of course totally neglected is that this is a quantum treatment, so actually all of that looks like that. Okay, so and why am I doing that? Well, because this provides us with a rate. So in order to get a rate, we need to rewrite the axis dimensionless. Right, so basically, just you dig out your quantum harmonic oscillator work package. So this is now g m square over d cubed, and each x is simply given by sigma. So this is the ground state size of the particle divided by a plus times a plus a dagger. Right. So basically what you get now is here sigma square, and you get an a plus a dagger and a b plus b dagger, where these are now simply the the creation annihilation operators for the motional degree of freedom along the x direction of your harmonic oscillators. Right? And this now, how do you get a rate? Well, the point is this is now equivalent to h bar g, the rate, right, of your xx coupling, right? Which means now you get an entangling rate out of that. You see that the rate at which you generate entanglement is simply given by g over h bar, m squared divided by d, sigma squared divided by d squared. So this is now the rate at which you produce entanglement between these two systems. Okay? So this is the entanglement rate. Note a couple of things. The whole thing scales with the mass square. It scales with the size of the delocalization, right? And it obviously scales with 1 over the distance because the interaction increases when you go closer. Okay. Okay. Now we can put numbers if you want. Okay. Just to see how reasonable that is. Okay, let's put numbers. Wait, how do I do that? I just take this to the next page. So here's our entanglement rate. Numbers. Let's take an atom, two atoms, separated by a micrometer, just to get some, have something. Okay, so that means the G would then be G over H bar is 2 pi times 10 to the 23. Mass of an atom is, let's say, 10 to the minus 26 kilogram, no, because it's not a, not a hydrogen atom, but something else. So it's 10 to the minus 52. A micrometer is what, 10 to the minus 6. And then what about the sigma? So the sigma is something, so it's the ground state extension of a particle inside a trap. Okay, so basically you have your atom in your optical trap, let's say typical frequencies are on the order of a megahertz, right? So you get here 10 to the 6, you get here 10 to the minus 26, so that's 10 to the minus 20, 10 to the minus 34, then that's the square root of 10 to the minus 14, which means this is on the order of 100 nanometers. Okay? Which means that your sigma over d is on the order of 10 to the minus 1, so you get another 10 to the minus 2 here. Okay? So if you put everything together, you get a g of, forget about 2 pi, we have, what is it now? 10 to the minus 20... No, 10 to the 21, 10 to the 27, and 52, that's what, 10 to the 25, minus 25 hertz, okay? Which means the entanglement time, tau, for entanglement, achieving entanglement, is on the order of 10 to the 25 seconds, which is on the order of what, you know that much better than I, 10 to the 8 times the lifetime of the universe, right? T universe. Well, hard to believe that this is somehow reasonable to achieve in an experiment. Yeah, so this is basically just telling you gravitational coupling between individual atoms is very, very small. Yeah, I'm just... Okay, what about another example? Another example is two Planck mass objects. Two Planck masses separated by, I don't know, let's say... 100 micrometer. Okay, I increase the distance a little bit because Planck mass is like a larger object, like a 50 micron Lad sphere or so, and so I better separate them by more than a micrometer. And now we need to assume something, and what I assume is that we can get sigma, right, on the order of so wave packet delocalization. Okay, I'm super bold now, on the order of a nanometer. Okay? So I'm just assuming. Alex would say, hey, it's a free world, right? So I can just assume what I want. That's the challenge. It's still two orders of magnitude smaller than my atom. It's a wave packet size. So what's my G is now 2 pi 10 to the 23. The Planck mass is on the order of 10 to the minus 8 kilogram. So this is only 10 to the minus 16 here. Then here we get what do we say, 100 micron, this is 10 to the minus 4, right? So we get a 10 to the minus 4 here. And then we have 10 to the minus 4, this is 10 to the 7. 10 to the minus 7, that's 10 to the minus 3, so that's 10 to the minus 6 here, right? Which means I get 10 to the... 27 and 10 to the 22. So this is now, did I miss here anything? M squared, 10 to the minus 8, right? So I'm at 16. D is 10 to the minus 4. Sigma is 10 to, no, sorry, nanometer, 10 to the minus 9. So I knew. 10 to the minus 9 is the nanometer, and D was 10 to the minus 4, so 10 to the 5, so that's 10 to the 10 here. Okay. So now, that means you have, you see, 10 to the 27 times 10 to the minus 26, right? So this is on the order of 10 hertz, yeah? Which means the entanglement time is on the order of, say, 10 milliseconds. 100 milliseconds, sorry. Okay. So the question that I wanted to ask you before, and I didn't, if you were to take a guess, what is like the best timescale on which you can isolate a quantum system? Yeah, let's. I don't remember whose talk it was. Maybe it was Giorgio. Yes, it's the $100 million question. Okay, you get an infinite amount of money. So what do you think is going to be the time scale that you can isolate your quantum systems, meaning the time scale on which decoherence does not play a role? So what would be typical decoherence rates in the best experiment ever you can do that involves like massive objects? Any guess?
Because you could have here... It depends on how you isolate it. If you have 100 micron, one photon can do the job in principle.
Very nice. That's exactly. And one gas molecule. Right?
Yeah,
so the answer, exactly.
Yeah.
So it depends on how far you get with $100 million.
Yeah.
Right? Well, obviously, you will not get much lower than millikelvin temperatures. Yeah, so because there are things like that, physical laws at some point, right? You have like cooling powers and so on of fridges. There's only so much money can buy you. So let's say environment temperatures maybe on the millikelvin scale, right? And then of course, and gas pressures. Once you have low temperatures, gas freezes out. So maybe you do not even have to worry about gas molecules. Okay, so like. Even at pressures that we can easily achieve, like 10 to the minus 9 millibar or so in a lab, you have maybe one gas kick per second on a micrometer scale or even 100 nanometer scale object. Okay? So this is not a problem. But then you have black body radiation. Okay? So basically, and the problem with black body radiation, the amount of radiation that is emitted or scattered and absorbed and so on, scales dramatically with the temperature and the size of the object. Right? So for example, for 100 nanometer object in a room temperature environment, you already localize your particle, so you decohere on a millisecond timescale. But now if you go down in temperature by, let's say, 2 orders of magnitude, yeah, then suddenly you gain many, many orders of magnitude, like almost 12 orders of magnitude on the time scale. Of course, the size increases also, so you lose again 4 orders of magnitude. But I guess what I want to say is, if you take all of these things into account, and if you're really, really brave, then maybe you can argue a second is something that maybe you can achieve. Yeah. Even that, I mean, I personally, of course, we all want to operate on millisecond timescales, but I think it's not that you would be called completely insane if you say, well, in the future, I would like to have an experiment that operates on a second timescale. Okay. That's the typical timescales right now. You have atom interferometers, we already heard, right? I mean, there's like long fall times, 10 seconds, not a problem, right? And so it's not completely insane to talk order of seconds timescales. Good. By the way, I don't want to go now into so many details. Maybe a couple of additional things. So first of all, with this kind of argument, you can also basically argue that you need solids for such an experiment, because you could also say now, well, you know, we can have 10 to the 6 atoms in atomic gases. Yeah, 10 to maybe even 10 to the 8, 10 to the 9. Right? I show you where the problem is here. The problem is, as you already saw, if you want some decent rates, okay, then let's just take an example. One other example, okay. If your sigma over d, so the delocalization, okay, is on the order of, 1%, okay? So You have a distance between your object, and you say, well, I can delocalize it. I cannot delocalize it by that much. Okay, sigma d term is 2. You will see later it is already a large number. Okay, but let's assume we can do that, and let's assume distances is the only absolute number now. Sort of, you want to be somewhere in the 10 to 100 micron regime, and not really closer, first of all, because, well, objects are extended, and so you start to overlap the objects, but also you don't want to get too small, too close, because you have other forces coming into play. And you also always want to isolate gravity as a coupling force, so maybe 10 micron is like already stretching it, but I think this is something you can, just for an order of magnitude estimate. Okay, if you do that now, okay, let's just work with such a number, then you see, if you now say that you can get decoherence rates, okay, that are at best on the order of a second, then what you want is that your g has to be larger than 1, your coupling rate. Okay, because your coupling rate, this always needs to be larger than your decoherence rate in order to generate anything quantum. Yeah? And so if this is now bounded through experiment to the order of 1, then you see immediately what that means now. It means that m square has to be larger than, right? And now it's basically just h bar over g times d times d over sigma square, right? So this is, what did we say, 10 to the minus 23. The d was 10 to the minus 5. Then the d over sigma is 10 to the 2, so it's 10 to the 4, right? So this is now what? This is on the order of 10 to the minus 10 to the minus 12 squared. Right? So all of this is SI, right? So kilogram. 10 to the minus 12 kilograms squared. Right? Which is like 10 to the minus 4 times the Planck mass. It's also not so bad. Okay, but this mass has to be localized, obviously, in a volume that is smaller than d cubed, right? So that means the density that I have to have for my mass configuration has to be definitely larger than mass over d cubed. So 10 to the minus 12 divided by, what was my d? Was my 10 to the minus 5, no? So this is 10 to the minus 15. So that's on the order of 10 to the 3 kilogram per cubic meter. This is solid state densities. Right, we heard yesterday from George's talk, this is like on the order of 1.5 times 10 to the 3 is what they have in their silica spheres. Okay? 2 times 10 to the 4 is what you have in lead in superconducting particles. Okay? So, and remember, densities of atomic gases, they are like 6 orders of magnitude away from that, 7 orders of magnitude away from that. So there's no way you can compensate in an experiment for that, if you choose this kind of approach, if you really want to gravitationally interact. So a last thing, this is more or less a homework problem for you guys. What we looked at now is such a configuration, okay? So we have two harmonic oscillators, or just two harmonic oscillators, so two masses that we prepare with Gaussian wave packet delocalization, and they interact gravitation. There's another thing you can do. What you also can do is you follow essentially ideas that we already saw and that Jason also beautifully showed. So we start with a mass. So I stick to the same scheme here. Right, I have a mass along the x direction, okay? And now what I do is I prepare both of my masses in a superposition to begin with. Okay, so I have now a delocalization delta x. If I would plot now just the real part of my wave packet, then, this thing now would look like that, right? So this is the state. It's now two non-Gaussian states that you prepare. Really, each center of mass degree of freedom is now in a macroscopically distinct superposition of the object being here and there. okay? And I keep the distance again at d, right? And what I get now is, you see, this is like a like this mass. So now I have the Aharonov-Bohm effects that Jason explained so nicely. Okay, so you see that this mass here sees the potential of that mass, yeah, or of that mass. Okay, so and that means what I have now that my system one gets a phase shift. So the wave packet of my system gets a phase shift, right? That is proportional to 1 over h bar, the integral of the mass times the potential that it sees, right? dt. And this potential here, this phi is just given by g times the mass of the other system divided by r, right? And now I have two possibilities for my r, right? My r can either be just d, right? This is this configuration, or my r is simply d square plus delta x square and the square root of that. Okay. And now the question to ask is, so this is now for all the quantum information guys. Everyone who has thought about that, this is just a conditional phase gate, okay? So, because what you have now is, you see, you start out in the following state. So, initial state psi naught is you have the mass one in a superposition of left plus right. And you have your mass 2 in a superposition of left and right. And what happens now is, as time evolves, you see you pick up conditional phase shifts, right? Because you see that your x left, these are those two, right? They pick up a phase, e to the I phi, where phi is given by this potential here where r equals d. And x right, x left, so this is this coupling here, they pick up a phase shift. So we basically have these two options. So r1 is actually d, and r2 is square root of d square plus delta x, plus delta x square. Yeah? So you see what happens. Those four contributions now in the term, they pick up different phase shifts, such that at the end of the day, you can rewrite this whole state here as x left of particle 1, okay, times x left of particle 2 plus e to the I phi 1 of x right 2 plus x right particle 1 x right particle 2 plus e to the I phi 2, that's already the delta phi, because I take out the 1 in front of the whole thing, so e to the I phi 1 is in front of the whole thing, so the delta phi is left, and also here, e to the I delta phi x left 2. You see, and you see this here is an entangled state if, so we call this now x right tilde of 2. We call this x left tilde of 2. So this whole thing is entangled if x left tilde, x right tilde is 0. Right? And what is x left tilde, x right tilde? It's just the scalar product between the two. This is just e to the I delta phi plus e to the minus I delta phi. So this is just modulo factors of 2 that enter here with 1 over root 2, so those cancel again. So this is just cosine delta phi. You see now that the entanglement in this system increases with delta phi, with the phase difference that you accumulate. So the question is, what is now the delta phi? Well, the delta phi, this is here, you see? The delta phi is simply, you see, 1 over h bar, is 1 over h bar, right, times, the integral of this thing, and then the difference of the two different, r's, right? I mean, you see that you're much faster than I in these things. So this is this one. If you do the integral and the difference, then what's left is gm over r. You Taylor expand this part here, okay? So it means what's left is just a, it's a 1 minus, 1 plus delta x square divided by d square, and a factor of 2 somewhere, minus 1, okay, times t. So that means the entanglement rates that I get, the rate at which these systems entangle via this effect, the entanglement rate is simply d over dt delta phi, so the change in my phase evolution, which is simply g over h bar, as an m square, and there's a d, m square divided by d, delta x divided by d square. Which is exactly the same than our two harmonic oscillators. Okay, so it's two different schemes, and they entangle exactly at the same rate. Which means now, this is now for the lesson for the experimentalist is you can choose which of the two architectures you find more convincing or more simple to realize. Okay, do you want to have Gaussian wave packets and delocalize them by a large amount? Or would you rather like to start with a well-defined center of mass degree freedom and then delocalize that in a superposition of macroscopically distinct states? So would you, is it better for you in the experiment to prepare a large non-Gaussian state, or is it better to prepare a large Gaussian state? And to be honest, up to this date, I don't have an answer to that question. Okay? I give you an example. So you see now in all cases, what is the relevant parameter, okay? So it seems from that you can say the relevant parameter is actually you need to maximize m square delta x square divided by d cube times the coherence time. So it seems to be that this is the number you need to maximize for this type of experiment, okay? So whenever you fall short on one of these parameters, you can make up for it on the other one, right? So let me show you, and you see, this one here, everything in the up here applies to a single system, because now the task that I have now experimentally is, first of all, I need to be able to generate a single system in a large delocalized state with as large mass as possible and super long coherence times. Okay? And once I have that, I double it and place it at a distance d from the other one. Right? So this is why this d cubed is actually, at the end, not really relevant. So what really matters is m delta x square and the coherence time. This is the relevant number for the experiments. Okay, I give you two examples. So the upper one here, so these are two examples of experiments where the center of mass degree of freedom was essentially delocalized. Okay? The first one is from my dear colleague Markus Arndt in Vienna. He did, together with Anton Zeilinger, the famous buckyball experiments, where you basically have an absorption grating with a double slit, you send the buckyballs through, and you see an interference pattern. They hold right now the world record for macromolecule interference, so they have a huge complex molecule that contains 2,000 atoms, okay? And they send it through a phase grating. So that means in a way you can think about that is that now this atom is delocalized at least over the distance of the grating size, Yeah, so that means you have a superposition size of the molecule of 2,000 atoms of at least 500 nanometer. This is like it's an optical standing wave, so this is the delocalization that you have. That you have to have in order to see interference fringes. Yeah? So that means you have a mass, right? So 10 to the minus 23 kilogram, you have a delocalization, and you end up at a number of in the order of 10 to the minus 29. It's just a number. So then you say, oh, then now I want to ramp up mass. Okay, so what do? You go to a solid. Yeah, many atoms on a small volume, and here's a solid. So this is an aluminum nitride disk, okay, that is sandwiched between two aluminum plates, and this thing can oscillate. It can perform thickness oscillations. And if you're smart, as Andrew Cleland was a couple of years back, you can couple that to a superconducting qubit, and you can capacitively basically steer the thickness here. And what you can then eventually do is you can transfer single excitations of the qubit onto motional excitations of your aluminum nitride plate, and you get a non-Gaussian state for a thickness oscillation state in this plate. So in an atomistic picture, what it means is you have a superposition of all the atoms being arranged in one sort of layer, and then all the atoms being arranged in a different set of layer, such that the relative displacement between the atoms is on the order of 10 to the minus 16 meters. So subnuclear dimensions. Okay, but still they could see some Ramsey interference. So basically, it's fair to write this state as a superposition. It's just a super tiny displacement. Okay. Funny side notes, if you take the displacement that you get, 10 to the minus 16, times the mass that they have, 10 to the 13 atoms now, so 10 to the minus 13 kilogram, 10 orders of magnitude more, the product is 10 to the minus 29. Both experiments, completely different regimes, okay, same number. So you can already see where the difficulty is. It seems right now that the larger the mass, the more difficult it is at the moment to really create sort of large microscopic distinct superpositions. Right? And this is sort of the message of this plot here, where on the left side, I basically try to sketch the domain right now of quantum experiments where you have spatial delocalization of matter. And you see upper left with long coherence times are all the beautiful atomic physics experiments with single atoms or macromolecules and so on that are free-fall experiments not coupled to the environment. They basically just live happily ever after in a non-interacting environment, however, at extremely small masses. So from single atoms to maybe 10 to the 3, 10 to the 4 atoms. Then you can crank up the mass, you go to solid-state systems, but you lose coherence time. Okay, so that's a problem. Plus, and so this is the third dimension here that I did not plot, also you lose delocalization size at the moment. Okay? So we don't have a way right now to delocalize a 10 to the 13 atom object by 500 nanometers. Right. And on the same time, you see here, this is the domain of gravity because the question that you have to ask now as an experimentalist is twofold. Number one, the question that I now just was bragging about all the time, how large can I make a quantum system and how can I maximize my mass times delocalization times coherence time number? Okay? That's a quantum question. So how large can I eventually make my quantum system and still have it coherent? The second question is coming from exactly the opposite direction. So let's assume I managed to do that. Then I still have the challenge of taking then two systems, put them next to each other, and couple them gravitationally. And it turns out that this is also a non-trivial task. This is something that I assume David will talk a lot in his lecture. He will tell you, I guess, a lot about experiments, and I assume that one of the lessons will be that it's extremely hard to measure gravity, in particular when the objects become smaller. And we heard it also from Giorgio yesterday. So this is why a second question you have to ask, what do I have to do in order to isolate gravity as the interaction between two particles experimentally? I remember, I think I told this story to Mina a couple of days ago. So I had Ephraim Steinberg as a guest maybe 15 years ago. And I was already like telling him about, oh, wouldn't it be cool to do his experiments? And, and at some point, he was so fed up with me because I think I, like 3 days, I was just talking into him. And then he at some point just said, Marcus, stop talking about it. You cannot even measure the gravitational field of that chair. Yeah? And he was pointing at the chair in my office. And I was... he was right. I suddenly realized I know how to do quantum experiments, but I have no idea if I now would have two quantum systems, what I would have to do in order to isolate gravity between them. So this is why we decided we have to start a second line of research in our lab to basically go to smaller and smaller source masses for gravitational coupling. So basically probe the bounds and learn while we do that how can we isolate gravity. I would now still show you a couple of experimental steps in that direction, but I shortly stop talking, start breathing, and see if there's any questions.
Thanks, Marcus. So maybe speaking to this just very last point that you made, suppose you do all this, you get the coherent masses and everything, and then how can you possibly be sure that the interaction is not some van der Waals,
exactly,
just quadrupolar, or some higher order polarizability?
Right. That's exactly the question. And this is why we're doing gravity experiment now, where we try to understand how can we exclude all the other influences, or at least how can we know the other influences so well that we can be sure what is the gravity contribution.
But what are the orders of magnitude? I mean, like if you take your, because you ran some estimates, which is great, but then if I do take those things, and I do take polarizability, for instance, just simple polarizability, how would that compare to a gravitational force between the two? So how much entanglement, like you go, and you see entanglement, great. How will you know it's not electrostatic?
Exactly. So I will show a little bit of that very, very quickly. But the short message is right now, and I really would like to hear other opinions here. Right now, my belief is that experimentally we will have to and we will shield electromagnetic forces. So basically, there needs to be an additional shield. And the shield needs to be in such a way, we already saw yesterday in George's talk, how basically charge configurations can mess up even in the presence of a shield. So that's something we need to learn. Okay, this is right now work in progress. And my firm belief is that we can come up with an experimental design where the shield is in such a way that we can exclude for the experimental configuration that we have that electromagnetic forces dominate.
Thanks.
Thanks.
Hello. Thank you for this really, really great talk. Can you give a wager or some sort of sense of what the time scale you think progress
Definitely.
Is here? Is this like a 20-year time scale or is this a 100-year time scale?
No, I have a very definite time scale for that. It's 19 years.
Okay.
Because I'm going to retire in 20 years. You know, Austria has mandatory retirement, so it better be done in 19. Yeah? That's a firm set time scale.
Perfect.
And it's not totally unrealistic, okay? Let's talk in 5 years again, right? So actually what I realized, because you start doing timescales for that, and I made a shocking discovery. If I look back now in my career, so it turns out we all get older, right, as we get older. If I look back in my career, like significant experimental steps sort of happened on a five-year basis. So that means I only have 4 steps left. So basically, I now very carefully need to formulate the 4 necessary steps that I need in order to arrive where I want to be. And that was actually it was a quite depressing discovery, but it's also. They're in discussion. Yeah. But okay, I can briefly say something about that. Okay, so this answer the question. Anything else? There's one more thing I would like to say, because we are running out of time, and because we had this discussion yesterday, I briefly mentioned the three levels of excitement on the Dvali scale, and I at least very quickly want to make the argument for the third level of excitement, yeah, because I mentioned it. Yeah? So basically, let's start again in a superposition of my mass, okay, with left and right. And now I assume that now I assume again the, you know, the validity of being able to write down here some state of the field, okay, alpha left, and this is now really, this is the gravitational field that I somehow, well, write as a cat, okay, and alpha right. So this is the field that tags along with the mass, yeah? And now this thing. What you do with that is imagine that you now have a clock, okay? So just some clock, tau left, okay, of my clock, and states tau right of my clock. Right? So basically, sorry, what I should have done, well, you know what I mean, no? Basically, you have this state here. So take this state, and you couple this state here, you now couple to a clock that sits somewhere, right? So let's assume here's our experiment. So here we have our mass in a superposition, right, with a delocalization delta x, and then at a distance here, here sits my clock, okay? Right? And so what presumably happens is, again, that here what would happen is, as time goes by, I now develop that in an entangled state, right? Because, and now I just, take this one, right? So basically, as time flows, you will end up then in an entangled state, tau left and tau right, okay? And now what that means is, of course, if this were now the correct description of my system, then, and I would just look at the properties here of here my subsystem here. So I only do experiment on this subsystem. I ignore the clock. Okay, the clock is there, but I ignore it because here's my lab, and so basically I now do just an interference experiment with this system here. Okay, or I have an experiment to measure the purity of my state. Okay, well the point is if I do that, then obviously so the way to describe my mass now is basically, so this is here, this is my psi total, okay, is by tracing out the clock degree of freedom of my overall state here, okay? And if I do that, obviously, and if those two states here, delta left, delta right, are orthogonal, then this will simply be a mixed state, okay? So then basically I end up in my, well, whatever, you know. You know what I mean? Yeah, so you get a psi tilde left plus psi tilde right, which is mixed. Yeah, it's maximally mixed. So basically, there's no coherence left if the two clock states would be really orthogonal. Okay. So this would be it. So if one could do such an experiment, then I would be able to observe now loss of interference visibility in this system. Because the field degree of freedom has become entangled with my clock. Yeah, so this would be on a completely different level now of interpretation. And now, of course, you can ask, well, okay, what would it take? So let's take mass. Let's say the mass here is the Planck mass, okay, and let's say the distance is again what? 10 microns. Huh? So what is the distance? Sorry, the distance is now this here. Hmm? This is the distance. Okay? Distance is again 10 microns. What else do we need? And we do again our delta x over d on the order of 10 to the minus 2, like we always do. Okay? And now the question is, what is the frequency sensitivity of my clock that I need in order to be able to resolve this potential difference here? Yeah, because this is what I would need in order to develop into two different clock states. Right? Well, so my, my delta nu over nu is something like delta u divided by c or c squared. Damn, this is the problem of SI units. C or c squared. That's, as I said, that's the problem of SI units, because now we really need, I think it's c squared. Now I don't remember, damn it. I think it's c squared. Okay, I can look it up if you want. Let me look it up. Does anyone know by heart? Does anyone know by heart? No? Let me see. I think it's c. This is why when I follow 2 by c, it's c square. Okay, good. So it's c square. Huh? No, it is c square. I just checked. Okay, good. So are we back? Sorry. Did I do something wrong? Ah, there it is. Sorry. Delta u now, being again, no, this is now just, here's our mass, right? Delta u is now gm divided by d minus gm divided by d minus delta x, right? It should be the other way around, okay? Which is simply gm over d times delta x over d, right? That's linear in that case. Which means, did I forget something? There's no h bar in that case now, right? Yeah. The units are still... No, it should be fine, no? Let me see. Let me see. I need to go my notes. No, it should be fine. No, that's fine. It's fine. It's all good. Right? No, it's all good. You have anything now? Yeah, that's all good. So now we rechts öffnen, unten öffnen. Why does it not? It's potential. Yeah, right. Right. So we have now 6 times 10 to the minus 11. The mass is the Planck mass. It's 10 to the minus 8, right? D was what? 10 to the minus 5. And delta x over d is 10 to the minus 2, right? And basically, that means now, you see, this is now 10 to the minus 10, 10 to the minus 21, 10 to the minus 16, right? And if you divide that by c squared, it's 10 to the minus 16 divided by 10 to the 16, so it's on the order of 10 to the minus 32. That's what you would need to have for a clock. Okay? Right now, we are at 10 to the minus 20. 20 years ago, clock stability was, maybe 40 years ago, clock stability was at 10 to the minus 10. Okay? So 40 years, 10 orders of magnitude. Who knows? Yeah, I mean, this is not my 19-year timescale. Yeah, but my point is, it's also not 10 to the minus 100. Okay, so this is something now one really. If you listen to talks by Junyi and so on, obviously there are limits on clock stability due to local influences. But this is not the point here, right? So the point is that this is an environment where you are influenced directly by this mass here, right? So this clock can even fluctuate; it doesn't matter because it's just the relative, proper time difference that it accumulates. So I don't think it is completely insane to look into a far future where something like that could even be done. Yes, question.
So So why do you need the clock for this? Couldn't you do this with the experiment that's just two masses, each of which are separated into some macroscopic superposition? You're saying the problem is there the superpositions that are accessible generally have large overlap with themselves?
Yeah, no, in that case, the argument is really that the clock couples to the field degree of freedom. So we had the discussion yesterday. So in all the experiments I'm describing with the mass being in a superposition, of course, in principle, if you're from a purely puristic point of view, the experiment is in a regime where you don't require a field description of your experiment. Okay, with a mass in a superposition, I can do everything just in a Newtonian framework. And this is why my statement yesterday was, in such an experiment that I showed with the superposition of masses, what you show is that if you assume a field description, then it's incompatible with a classical field plus quantum theory. But you perform the experiment in a regime where it's not necessary to use a field description. If you now add a clock degree of freedom, you are already going at least to a post-Newtonian regime. Yeah? So it's a stronger experimental argument than just working a regime where you really do not need where you can live just with Newton alone.
So I agree it's a strictly stronger experiment by this definition, but like it would be a very bizarre world where Einstein gravity works great on big scales, but on small scales, you think it's Newtonian gravity.
Exactly.
Plus one.
Thank you. Exactly. Totally my argument. Yes. That's exactly my point. Yeah. From yesterday. Thank you. Yeah. I'm out of time. So I show you two more slides just to give you the gist. Okay. And then we can still discuss and so on. But I don't want you guys to be dragged again until like 8 p.m. yesterday or so. Okay, here I show you now our current two strategies. Okay, so the one is in the gravity domain. What we are trying to do right now is we're trying to measure gravity from as small source masses as possible. And here's just one example. So the very first attempt we did was we basically took a 90 milligram gold mass, so it's a small gold sphere. And we wanted to just see whether we can measure gravitational coupling to that. And we did that in a very simple miniature version of a Cavendish experiment. So like, who talked about the Cavendish? One of you guys, sorry, I don't remember. So, was it Giorgio? Yeah, exactly, Giorgio. Right, so really, you have a small mass, you juggle the mass, you get here time-dependent gravitational interaction, and then you just ring it up. You ring it up because it's a torsional pendulum, you know, the acceleration modulation is on the order of 10 to the minus 11 g, so that means the displacement is only on a few nanometers. So if you actually put that thing into a regular lab environment, so this is the torsional pendulum, and you just let it sit there and you look at the response of the pendulum over time. So what you see here is the different frequencies and how much the pendulum is actually accelerated, displaced at different frequencies. So what you see is yellow is a lot, blue is nothing. Okay, and then you see at the fundamental frequency, here you have a lot of noise, yellow. Basically, it's shaken up completely. And it turns out that exactly this 10 millihertz, this is the traffic light cycle of a road crossing that is 100 meters away from our lab. Yeah, and it just shakes up our pendulum. Okay? And then you see, as you go in time, suddenly there's these very dark streaks where nothing happens. And this is where the tram traffic stops. This is between midnight and 5 a.m. in the morning. It's simply quiet, okay? But it's also not really always quiet. You see, it's like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 dark stripes, and then there are two less dark stripes. And this is Friday night and Saturday night, when people are really just going out. Yeah? So you see, this is the things we basically then you have to deal with. But again, this is, I think David is going to talk a lot more about it. And at the end, well, what we managed was to really measure gravitational signal there also now. Alex, the main point was really to have a shield that could really, where we could be sure that that we can exclude electrostatic interactions. And at the end of the day, we saw now a gravitation-induced response of the pendulum because it's modulated in a 1 over r potential. You also get higher orders. So in the frequency response here, you do not only see the first order, you also see the second order. And you see that we detected a modulation of the size of 10 to the minus 11 g, but the precision with which we detected it was on the order of 10 to the minus 13 g. So we had a 1% precision level in the experiment. It's not a precision measurement for Newton's constant. There we are still many, many digits away. But we could be sure, including all the systematics, that 90% of the signal we saw is gravity. Okay, so this was the main thing here. And now the next steps that we are doing, you see this is our current source mass, and now we're going to smaller one. So at the moment we're building an experiment where the source mass is actually the Planck mass. And so in your language, this will be a alpha equals one experiment. So where we basically, we measure gravitational coupling, actual gravitational coupling to this Planck mass object. And of course, then you cannot have street cars and so on. So this is why we do this whole thing in a tunnel. And so it's already set up in this mine. So we have here this concrete block where the experiment is being built, and so on and so on. So this is the gravity direction. Okay, this is the strategy is now to go to smaller and smaller masses. Eventually, we need to combine this with the ideas that Giorgio presented yesterday, namely that when you levitate an object instead of hanging it on a thread, you have much better control over it. You can discharge it, you can rotate it, you have so many beautiful degrees of freedom that also these experiments will have to be levitated. Okay, so this is like, this is now talking about the four experimental steps for the future, for the next 19 years. This is step number one, is do such a gravity experiment in a levitation setting. So the second thing I would like to mention, and again, I just do that now very quickly in passing, is that we, for the quantum regime, what we want to do is we are now pursuing experiments where we try to have as large masses with as long coherence times as possible. And I showed you already this, you know, this solid state resonator experiments. And you also have here, you will hear a lecture by Conrad today or tomorrow. He's one of the pioneers for really bringing those mechanical systems in a quantum regime. We thought, well, let's not attach them to something. Yeah? Like here, this is a real problem. But let's just take a mass, a solid, and levitate it. Take it, levitate it, isolate it, and really this is exactly what you heard by Giorgio yesterday. Okay? But use that now, this level of control and isolation that you have now, to control the object in the quantum regime. And this is like development over the last 15 years where several of us here in the audience have been part, where we learned control techniques from quantum optics, from atomic physics, that allow us using basically laser drive and so on of your solid state object to control those objects in the quantum regime. Again, I don't have the time now. I give you a simple example. Simple example is you learned from Giorgio yesterday that you can just take a laser beam, focus it down, and trap a particle in the laser beam. In Giorgio's case, it was micron scale particles. We do nanoparticles. So this is now a 150 nanometer diameter particle that we trap here in front. This whole thing is in a vacuum chamber. And what we do now, I spare you with the details. You know, there's lasers that actually trap it. Then you have laser lights scattered forward to get some information about the position. But what we are doing now is we look at the back reflected light. So actually, so you see we have here now an apparatus where in the back reflection, we monitor the light. When the particle moves, it imprints a phase on the light. And we can read out the phase modulation. It gives us position information. And we can do that with such a precision that the product between imprecision due to back action onto the object and readout noise of our system is limited by Heisenberg's uncertainty. So this is a so-called Heisenberg-limited measurement, which means, I just translate what that means, that you can reconstruct the state of the particle with a precision that is limited only by the ground state uncertainty of the particle. And no matter in which state the particle is. So if I have a room temperature particle and I monitor it with such a Heisenberg-limited detection, it means I can follow the trajectory of the particle while it's at room temperature with a ground state precision. So I can follow actually the quantum trajectory of the particle. If I would do time as average, I would just see a thermal state. Okay, but what I do is actually I follow the dynamics given by the stochastic Schrödinger equation of the system. Okay? And that also means, of course, now that when I have that information, I can also be clever and establish an active feedback loop to just stabilize the particle in one point in phase space, which means I cool it to the quantum ground state of motion just by feedback. Right? So this is what we did. And what you see here, this is a beautiful picture. What you see here, this is a glass bead, a silica glass bead, 150 nanometers, that is sitting in its quantum ground state of motion in a room temperature environment. Yeah? And I think you guys are all much more familiar with the event horizon telescope pictures. Yeah? So this is actually, you see, this is the difference between quantum and gravity. Quantum is green, gravity is orange. And it's the only difference. Okay, I think that's it. I stick with that. So that the challenge is now. So you see, what we have now is essentially, we have now, there it is. So this is what we can do already. Okay, so we can now, cooling something to the ground state of motion, such a large particle, means we can prepare pure state wave packets. And now, as I told you, what we need now is we need to make delta x large. And delta x either in the sense of a Gaussian delocalization, so of a delocalization of a Gaussian wave packet, or in the separation here of a non-Gaussian state. One of the two. You pick yours, okay? If you have ideas how to do either of that, we do have ideas, we're trying them out, but any new idea in that direction is super, super welcome, okay? This is my challenge for you. Come to me, tell me how we should do it, and the second challenge for you is then, of course, the decoherence challenge, right? What are the main sources of decoherence? How can we sort of circumvent them? How can we estimate them? And so on and so on. Okay, so with that I stop. I leave you my, I think this is the, actually, this is the more important challenge. So this is my challenge for you. You have my email, contact me. I'm more than happy to discuss. You find, if you search the archive, you find a couple of proposals from us, how to do that, but again, I would like to see more innovative approaches. I'm pretty sure we are just at the beginning of coming up with beautiful ways how to go the whole nine yards. Okay, thanks a lot, and I take questions.